translation. If one's heart does not change, tears do not flow from his eyes, his body does not shiver, nor his hairs stand on end as he chants the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, it should be understood that his heart is hard as iron. This is due to his offenses at the lotus feet of the Lord's holy name. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, commenting on this verse, which is a quotation from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 2, Chapter 3, Verse 24, remarks that sometimes a Mahabhagavata, or a very advanced devotee, does not manifest such transcendental symptoms as tears in the eyes. Although sometimes a Kanishta Adhikari, neophyte devotee, displays them artificially. This does not mean, however, that the neophyte is more advanced than the Mahabhagavata devotee. The test of the real change of heart that takes place when one chants the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra is that one becomes detached from material enjoyment. It is sometimes found that a Kanishta Adhikari, a neophyte devotee, shows artificial tears in his eyes while chanting the Hare Krishna mantra, but is still completely attached to material things. If it is sometimes found that a Kanishta Adhikari, neophyte devotee, shows artificial tears in his eyes while chanting the Hare Krishna mantra, but is still completely attached to material things, his heart has not really changed. The change must be manifested in terms of one's real activities. I think I'll read that final sentence again. The change must be manifested in terms of one's real activities. Tazasma sharam hridayang batedang yadgriya manaya harinama diyai navikriye tata yada vikaro nitre jalam gatra ruhesha harshaha. If one's heart does not change, tears do not flow from his eyes, his body does not shiver, nor his hair stand on end as he chants the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, it should be understood that his heart is as hard as iron. This is due to his offences at the lotus feet of the Lord's holy name. Amagyama Timarandasya Jinandina Shalakaya Chakshura Militang Yena Tasmai Shi Gurave Namaha Vanchakalpa Turubhyastha Kripasindubhyavcha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shri Vasudhi Gaura Bhaktivinoda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. I'll try and speak on how this might be practically relevant to us. Can anyone identify with iron hearts? Yes. You don't have to put your hand up. It's okay. Yeah. It's one of those verses that makes you think, oh my God, I've got a long way to go. Yeah. One should never feel too bad about that, by the way. I'd like to discuss this a little bit. How this is relevant for us, and particularly in terms of our spiritual development. This verse is somewhat significant for me because it reminds me of one of my first encounters with a devotee, which I think many of us feel are significant. whether they be, the first encounters we have, they're always, I think, significant for us. Some of you are Sankirtan devotees, book distributors. I think there are still some around you. They may be familiar with Birmingham. Yes, it's... Are you Birmingham? We were talking about Birmingham, weren't we? Yes. I was born there, sorry. Don't like to admit it, but I was. So you'll know in Birmingham there's a place called The Ramp. I don't know if it's still called that, but the Sankirtan, when we were doing Sankirtan book distribution later on, we used to call it The Ramp. So it's outside New Street Station. So I first encountered a devotee there. And this was really interesting because he showed me, and later on we didn't, I don't think we did this very much, but he actually showed me a copy of The Nectar of Devotion. And he actually turned to the chapter where the symptoms of ecstasy were there. I mean, this wasn't a common kind of tactic on Sankirtan when I later saw books. Vishvambara can tell me whether he uses this tactic. So that devotee actually showed me the symptoms of ecstasy. And I must say, I was impressed. I thought, yes, this is something to go for. This is something I would aspire after. But what was equally had an impact on me, although I think it had more of an impact, was the fact that the devotee seemed to be extremely centered. I think that's the right word. He was fixed. He was undisturbed, despite being in the middle of Birmingham. If you know Birmingham, yeah. Where everyone seemed to be, I think as I perceived it, chasing their minds. I know that's the phrase that somehow comes into my mind, at least. So it's interesting, actually, how on one hand, I was attracted to that very high level of Krishna consciousness, but something else struck me that I'd like to explore, and that's the notion of being dhira or undisturbed. And this is relevant to this verse because there are those who try to jump immediately to that advanced stage. How is this relevant to us? Well, let's explore. Do we sometimes do the same? And what are some of the pitfalls in our progress in Krishna consciousness? I'd like to do this by actually just running through a few points, possibly of understanding and addressing some possible misunderstandings on three things. First, I'd like to point to the focus on the heart and the emotions. What role do they play? Secondly, I'd like to look at the second point, I'd like to look at the gradual nature of the process. That word gradual, and also the stages. And I'd also like to address the issue of evaluating our spiritual progress, or possibly evaluating others' spiritual progress. Okay. This verse is quoted from the Bhagavatam, Canto 2, Chapter 3, Verse 34, I believe, yes. I'd like to read something from the purport. By the way, what time do we finish? Because I was told, Nagan, you told me it began at 1:45, but it began at 1:30. What time do we finish? Just so I do finish with time for questions and answers. 8:45. Okay, I'll try and finish earlier. But 9 is the absolute minimum. 8:45 preferably still? Is that still the case? Okay, fine. Thank you. I'll read from the purport, and this is about changing the heart. The whole process of spiritual culture is aimed at changing the heart of the living being in the matter of his eternal relationship with the Supreme Lord as subordinate servant, which is his eternal constitutional position. So with the progress of devotional service, The reaction of change in the heart is exhibited by gradual detachment. That word is used again, gradual, interestingly. From the sense of material enjoyment by a false sense of lording it over the world, and increase in the attitude of rendering loving service to the Lord. It's interesting here how the heart is described. There's a metaphor used, like iron, right? Because iron is hard. Someone told me the other day that in some part of the world they make swords from that are very sharp, from stone. I was incredulous. I'm not quite sure how you make swords from stone, but they assured me it was true. Generally, you make it from iron. And of course, if you have an iron heart, that heart can also be somewhat sharp. It's interesting. I found an interesting passage from the Nectar of Devotion, comparing the heart to different substances. We might meditate on what our heart resembles, if not iron. A hard heart is compared to a lightning bolt, to gold, and to shellac. I wasn't quite sure what shellac is, but it's some kind of resin. I think it might be something similar to candle wax or something. Anyone know what shellac actually is? It's flammable, because in the Mahabharata, the Pandavas were housed in a residence made of shellac, and it burnt down, so it's flammable. So perhaps something like candle wax. Similarly, the hearts of those engaged in severe austerities and penances do not become very easily softened. We may return to that point. The golden heart becomes melted at high temperature, as in ecstatic love. It's hot. And the shellac heart is very easily melted in a slight temperature. Sometimes you notice something like ghee. Sometimes it's hard, but if the room is warm, it'll be melted, or the kitchen is warm, it'll be melted. Yeah. And the condition of the mind is compared to sunshine. As honey and butter become melted, even in slight sunshine, soft-hearted persons become easily melted. Nectar, however, nectar is one of those words that has really entered into the ISKCON language. There are some words that are really, we have some real insider jargon, don't we? Nectar. Actually, what does nectar mean, actually? Nectar is the opposite of poison. It doesn't just mean I'm happy. Nectar is that which gives life, whereas poison is that which takes away life. So according to many cultures, I think in the Greek culture also, they have something called ambrosia. I remember when I was young, there was some sweet rice they used to put in a tin, and it was called ambrosia. But quite befittingly, in a sense, because nectar comes from the moon. So according to our cosmology, that nectar emanates from the moon, which is connected to the heart. It's the presiding deity of the heart. It is the source of enjoyment, of bhava, of ras, of pleasure. So that nectar really means that which gives, not only tastes good, but it gives life and makes us immortal. So we talk about the nectar of immortality. Nectar, however, is by its nature always liquid. And the hearts of those who are in pure ecstatic love with Krishna are by nature always liquefied, just like nectar. So interesting, there's a very detailed analysis here of the heart What is important is that the emotions here for our discussion is that the emotions do play an important role in spiritual life. Mm-hmm. What is that role? We need to discuss, because some pitfalls are being mentioned here in regard to the sahajas, or those who chant and falsely display emotions. So the emotions do play a key role. There's some big discussions here. What's the relationship between the heart and the head? And actions also. What are some of those relationships? I'm reminded of, there was one, I guess you'd call him today a politician, Sir Walter Raleigh. Have you heard of Sir Walter Raleigh? No, if you're not from the, who's heard of Sir Walter Raleigh? Oh, good. Oh, Michael Gove would be pleased. Yes. The Secretary of State for Education will be happy with you. Very great British figure, if you know British history. He actually was the one who was, apparently he found the New World, or he was instrumental in finding the New World. And it's said that he brought tobacco back from the New World. And he was greatly favored by Queen Elizabeth. Later on, the next monarch, I don't know who it was, didn't favor him. So, as usually happens when kings don't favor their courtiers, they send them to the Tower and then to the block. So actually the story goes, whether it's true or not, I don't know, that when he was actually going to the block, or as he was there, the axeman was a gentleman. He was British. And he actually asked him, which way would you like to put your head? I guess he wanted to ensure he was comfortable. And so Walter Raleigh said, if my heart is in the right direction, what does it matter which way my head faces? So we might reflect on that for bhakti, because the heart plays a very important role, and it is the whole process of Krishna consciousness is not just an academic or intellectual exercise, or one engaging with belief or philosophy, but it has to do with the heart, and that's where the chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra comes in. However, there are pitfalls. The second point I'd like to make is that the process is gradual. Srila Prabhupada mentions in the same purport, we should note with profit that in the first three chapters of the second canto, a gradual process of development of devotional service is being presented. That's from the second canto, third chapter, verse 24. There are many, many mentions of the word gradual in the Gita also, in the third chapter, verse 43. One of many quotes, I will add. One may not give up work and prescribed duties all of a sudden, but by gradually developing Krishna consciousness, one can be situated in a transcendental position without being influenced by the material senses and the mind. By steady intelligence directed towards one's pure identity, this is the sum total of this chapter. However, I'm going to raise a question here. What does gradual mean? And I came across a passage in one devotional book, by a contemporary book, you could say, and it actually said, our progress can either be gradual or quick. And I thought, there's something not quite right there. After all, when you compare two items, they should be opposites. I recall when Tony Blair, late Prime Minister, not late that he's passed away, but he is no longer Prime Minister, said, we have to choose between democracy and evil. You can see how, it was like, similarly, there was an Islamic group in the UK some years ago, and they were saying, are you British or Muslim? Okay. Generally speaking, one has to compare opposites. So actually, the word gradual doesn't necessarily mean slow. Gradual is related to gradient. And you may have a steep gradient or a shallow gradient. But the point is, it is a gradient. There are no sudden steps. That's what gradual means. So therefore, when we say, or Srila Prabhupada says, or the Acharyas say, that Krishna consciousness is gradual, it doesn't necessarily mean slow. But it does mean that we have to proceed step by step. And Srila Prabhupada was once asked, what's the best way to advance in spiritual life? And he gave the example of walking. You put one foot on the ground. When it's firmly on the ground, you can then move the next foot forward. If you try and move the next foot forward before that first foot is firmly on the ground, one's in for an accident. Yeah? Interesting, isn't it? In spiritual life also, how that progress must be there. Now, it's interesting also that the Acharyas and the pure devotees have actually defined that process of devotional service in various ways, in great detail. It's not vague, but there's real clarity here in the process of devotional service. I've come across, I'm going to suggest this, almost three ways of looking at spiritual progress. First one, I'm going to change the order a little bit here, is the whole notion of going from karma to bhakti. Karma yoga to bhakti yoga. And Srila Prabhupada writes a very important purport, the final verse of the sixth chapter. Very important for understanding the relationship between the different yogas. Because it is only too easy to totally discount karma yoga, jnana yoga, and ashtanga yoga. In favor of bhakti. But if we actually totally exclude them, that is not a proper understanding. Bhakti yoga includes activity. Bhakti yoga includes knowledge. Bhakti yoga includes meditation. They're all there. But bhakti yoga fulfills activity. It fulfills our knowledge. It fulfills the process of meditation. Without Krishna consciousness, it's incomplete. We have to be very careful about this rather dichotomous way of thinking that we can somehow boost the credibility of bhakti by putting down others. We could come to that later. But you're aware of that tendency. That rather dichotomous thinking, where we feel that somehow if we put down something else, we become elevated. There's some psychology behind that. Yes? The culmination of all kinds of yoga practice lies in bhakti yoga. Of all other yogas are but means to come to the point of bhakti yoga. Yoga factually means bhakti yoga. All other yogas are progressions towards the destination of bhakti yoga. From the beginning of karma yoga to the end of bhakti yoga is a long way to self-realization. Karma yoga without fruitive results is the beginning of this path. When karma yoga increases in knowledge and renunciation, the stage is called jnana yoga. When jnana yoga increases in meditation on the supersoul, by different physical processes, and the mind is on him, it is called Astanga Yoga. And when one surpasses the Astanga Yoga and comes to the point of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, it is called Bhakti Yoga, the culmination. Factually, Bhakti Yoga is the ultimate goal, but to analyze Bhakti Yoga minutely, One has to understand the other yogas. But to analyze bhakti yoga minutely, one has to understand the other yogas. Some implications there. That's one process. There is another process given in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. And this, I think, is 1.1.11. Ado shraddha tato sadhu sanguta bhajana kriya tato nata nirviti sya tato nishti ruchi tataha ata shaktis tato bhavas tata prema bhidhanchiti sadakanam ayam premna padu bhave bhavat kramaha. Nine processes are listed very clearly. It's interesting, actually, the translation. Because actually, the first one is, what's the first one? Shraddha, which means faith. Notice how faith is translated. In the beginning, one must have a preliminary desire for self-realization. Sometimes faith is considered to be rather cognitive. In Christianity, some writers, some academics have written, particularly someone called Cantwell Smith, that actually in more recent years, faith has been identified with belief. You just believe. But notice, even though there may be some element of conviction in the philosophy, that may be there, there's also this element of desire. So the heart is involved from the beginning. There must be that desire. Isn't that true? Sometimes we get a desire. Maybe I'll become a devotee. It just crosses your mind. And then you're finished. You're finished. Maybe I'll become a devotee. I used to, at one stage, I met the devotees traveling with their van at Nottingham University. I knew they traveled in vans. So I begin to imagine, what's it like sitting in there with a shaved head inside a van? That's it. Finished. Finished. Yeah. In 1973, I shaved my head. And then I came down here. There was one devotee called Patita Pavana. And the first words he said to me was, "Welcome to the cult." He had a sense of humor. There must be that desire. It involves the heart. This will bring one in trying to associate with persons. You want to associate with persons who are spiritually elevated. In the next stage, one becomes initiated by an elevated spiritual master, and under his instruction, the neophyte devotee begins the process of devotional service. By execution of devotional service under the guidance of the spiritual master, one becomes free from all material attachments. That's the stage we begin engaging with those material attachments, yeah? I personally didn't take long in ISKCON before I realized that eating too much wasn't great. Yeah, probably about 4 or 5 weeks, I think. Yeah, this isn't good. Now I need to actually attempt to do that. Yeah. By the way, don't think that we're the only ones who are on that stage of anatta nirvritti in one. I mean, we are. Non-devotees aren't technically on that stage, but they also can identify with the need to control the senses. Don't think that we're the only ones who know this. They're trying to stop smoking. So they're walking around with their e-cigarettes because they know that if I smoke, there are consequences. I'll come to this later. Yeah. It's part of the human condition. Or the ladies, some of the ladies here will have at some time wanted to go on a diet to lose weight. And there's benefits, but it's difficult. So even the non-devotees, to some degree, can understand this. So one struggles to become free of material attachments, and then once those attachments are gone, when those attachments are beginning to clear, he attains steadiness and self-realization and acquires a taste, ruchi, for hearing about the absolute personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna. This taste leads one further towards attachment for Krishna consciousness, which is matured in bhava or ecstasy, or the preliminary stage of transcendental love of God. Real love for God is called prem, the highest perfectional stage of life. So there are 9 stages, very clearly delineated. Another model we might look at is moving through the modes. Do we have to move through the modes? That is a question. Can we not just say, I am in ignorance, but I am a devotee? I want to question that because I'll come to that later. Tadarajas tamo bhava kama loba deyas chiye chita ita anavidam stitang sattve prasidati. As soon as irrevocable loving service is established in the heart, the effects of nature's modes of passion and ignorance, such as lust, desire, and hankering, disappear from the heart. Then the devotee is established in goodness, and he becomes completely happy. Purport. The devotee is fixed at once in the mode of goodness, and he makes further progress to rise to the position of Vasudev, or the state of unmixed sattva, no more rajas or tamas, completely devoid of those. Only in the shuddha sattva state can one always see Krishna eye to eye by dint of pure affection for the Lord. Those 3 ways there we've mentioned of kind of framing, conceptualizing, if you want, the path of devotional service. I'm going to make another point here. There is a need to assess our spiritual advancement. Sometimes actually Srila Prabhupada, in connection with devotional service being the only means to of actually attaining Krishna consciousness or perfection, he uses the word automatically. I think we need to actually look at that word automatically, because automatically, Srila Prabhupada has a particular reason for using that word, but automatically also sometimes applies to automatums, machines. And machines are not conscious, despite the whole idea to make them conscious. Generally speaking, machines are not conscious. So do we have to be conscious in our spiritual development, or can we be unconscious? Now, I'm not going to say that actually transformation can't go on at a kind of subliminal level of which we're unaware. But generally speaking, one should be aware of what is going on in terms of our spiritual advancement. And I asked this question of Radhanath Swami in Belgium about a year ago. And he answered, why on earth do we have all those stories of saints and sages and kings who are actually exhibiting virtue and vice? They're meeting success and failure in their endeavors to meet moral dilemmas or in their spiritual progress. Why are those stories there? Because we're meant to engage consciously with this process of devotional service, to ask those questions. I'm going to move through this rather quickly, actually. Again, I just want to reiterate one point, and I'm going back a little bit. When we look at devotional service, bhakti yoga, compared to other yogas, we should actually differentiate between cause and effect. The point being made by Srila Prabhupada in using the word automatically is the only cause of perfection is Krishna consciousness, ultimately. And if you don't reach that stage, you will not reach perfection. But if we look at the effects of devotional service, we will see they must include, if one claims to be Krishna conscious, one has to have the results of the other yogas. One can't dismiss these other yogas, but not display knowledge and detachment. So we need to be careful about differentiating in looking at those relationships between the various yogas, between cause and effect. One has to have those. Therefore, it is said, tachradhana muneyo jnana vairagya yuktaya pushyantyatmani chatmanam bhakta shruta grihitaya. The seriously inquisitive sage, well equipped with knowledge and detachment, realizes the absolute truth by rendering devotional service in terms of what he has heard from the Vedanta Sutra. So he's actually executing devotion, rendering devotional service, but well equipped with knowledge and detachment. Srila Prabhupada also writes in Chaitanya Charitamrita, Majjalila, an advanced devotee situated on the platform of spontaneity is already very expert in shastric instruction, logic, and argument. So there's a need to be conscious of our spiritual advancement. Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur would recommend that every Ekadashi we reflect on our spiritual advancement over the previous fortnight. So it's a conscious process. I was also thinking, what about assessing ourselves? What about in assessing others, of which we need to be careful? What about sometimes those who've got a very important position in ISKCON? We need to actually see our progress, not only how far we're going, but also is the deviation as well, right? Just like an aeroplane, it really needs to know that it's deviating from the path before it disappears from the radar, or a ship before it hits a rock, right? So similarly, you know, do we know a devotee's been having difficulty simply because he... Do you still use the word bloop? We don't have it so much, do we? He leaves Krishna consciousness. Or breaks the regular... It's a little late. We should actually know a little earlier. What are some of the symptoms that there is some spiritual malaise? Very, very important. And how do we measure our Krishna consciousness? There are some important points here as related to this verse. What are the signs? I do remember going to Soho Street about 2 or 3 years ago, dressed as I often do as a kami, a non-devotee, a fruitive worker. And one devotee said to me, the devotee was very kind, he said, do you come here often? And I said, yes, yes. He was very polite, and then he says, at one point he said, oh, you're a devotee. And I kind of said, kind of. And then another point, he said, oh, you're a Srila Prabhupada disciple, at which point he fell to the floor and paid his obeisances, which is very endearing, that etiquette is fine. And actually, etiquette is very important, actually. But how do we exactly determine a person's spiritual advancement? It's very difficult. And perhaps for many of us in a social setting, there have to be external indicators. That's true. But if we actually go a little deeper and really want to look at my spiritual life, rather than me just thinking I'm a proper disciple, I've made it. You know, how do I do that? What are the signs of success? What are the symptoms of some challenge? I think these are important questions, which we can't really discuss in too much detail here, but I think it's important to know them. I mean, Srila Prabhupada also gave one, there may be different ones. Srila Prabhupada actually said, your love for me will be shown by how well you cooperate and avoid factions. Now, if we can, and I think it's reasonable to say, there's a good case for saying that our love for Srila Prabhupada represents our Krishna consciousness, it's synonymous with that, then I think we can say one of the signs that actually we're Krishna conscious is we're able to cooperate and we avoid factions. Another interesting point. I'm going to go on. What I want to do is quickly present the idea that there's a couple of main challenges we have, two main challenges in spiritual life. One is soft-hearted sentimentalism. We have that soft heart, but that compassion is not well placed. So it's often called sentimentalism. We're driven by the mind and the senses. And the other is becoming hard-hearted, self-negators. There's not a word as such as negators in the dictionary. I made it up. You know what it means. Self-negators, those who negate the self and negate the world and negate God and the divine in many ways. So these correspond to karma yoga, generally speaking, somewhat, and to jnana yoga. And they're represented, respectively, by the kind of examples of these are the sahajas, as mentioned in this verse, and also the impersonalists. These instructions, Ravindra Sarup Prabhu, who has actually wrote a very good essay saying about the Mayavadis, and he was reflecting on who are these Mayavadis Srila Prabhupada's talking about? Who are they? Maybe, you know, when he was in India, it was a group he had a kind of a difference with. And it's true, they may form some kind of cohesive body. There may be some who follow that. But actually, his conclusion at the end was that these instructions are meant for us to see whether or not we have those tendencies towards impersonalism. And I'm not talking about when you have a fight with someone in the ashram and then you call him an impersonalist. That's a false reading, by the way. Srila Prabhupada says we have differences because we're personless. So don't, when you mean insensitive, don't just use the word impersonalist so you can really put that person down. We know what you're doing. You Mayavadi, you. Right? But impersonalism, to understand what it really is, and we very conveniently put it up as belief in an impersonal God. There are other ways of negating the self. And it's very important we don't negate the self. Otherwise we become Atmaha. Killing the self. That's not the process of controlling lust. You pour water on it. I'll come to that later. I'm going to just quickly go through this because time is moving on. I just thought I'd actually look at some of the challenges with each of these. I'm going to run through these quite quickly. Number one, if you're a sentimentalist, number one, mistaking mundane emotions for the spiritual. Even when we feel some ecstasy, we should just be a little skeptical. We should enjoy chanting Hare Krishna, but we shouldn't think I'm already on that platform of bhava or something. And Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati mentions that, actually. They accept their material emotions to be indicative of advancement. They accept their material emotions to be indicative of their advancement. So there's one. Number two, as mentioned, attachment, being swayed by happiness and distress. Three, a lack of knowledge. Four, I've mentioned this, a tendency towards false egalitarianism. I'm not on a very high level, but we're all equal, Prabhu, we're all devotees. Sometimes an aversion to or criticism of scholarship. Even devotional. Actually, we have to become thoughtful. Oh, thoughtful men, relish Srimad Bhagavatam. We may not become scholars in the academic sense, but at least thoughtful, reflective. And here's another one. Rationalizing extreme liberalism through being honest about where I am. I'm just being honest, Prabhu. And therefore we actually give up the attempt in the name of honesty. Yeah? You know, the kind of three regulative principles, no meat, fish, or eggs. There are some other problems with the opposite, which is the impersonal path. One is decrying the emotions as rooted in matter. And the other problem is cynicism. You can become very hard-hearted if one tries to falsely renounce this world. A tendency towards a deep-seated but often well-concealed envy. If you are becoming very strict and undergoing some austerities, we should watch out for becoming envious. It's easy, for example, for old people, and I'm just about in that category, possibly, to become envious of the young. This is kind of Puritanism. We hate to see other people enjoy. Oh, God, it's horrible. Those young ladies, how they're dressed nicely. Oh, it's Maya. Or we criticize the rich. Why do we criticize them? What will you do when you get to Vaikuntha? Hard-heartedness, we've already mentioned. A deeply seated dissatisfaction. Yeah, still, we're trying to renounce. It's a painful process. And then falling back into materialistic activities which we decry. And Srila Prabhupada criticizes the Mayavadis, the impersonalists, for engaging in humanitarian work. Why? It's all Maya. Why are we doing it then? At least in our Krishna consciousness, when we distribute prasadam, we accept it as real. But it's all Maya, and then we engage in those activities. Actually, bhakti is neither of these two paths, accepting or rejecting. This is the human condition. Everyone understands this. We want to be happy. And we don't want to just be happy by being one of, I mean, there's two ways of being happy usually. Those who are gross and simply drink and go clubbing and get blind drunk, they're gross. And then there are those who are more intelligent and they try and do it in a more dignified way. Right? We become middle class, or we become intellectuals or scholars, or we renounce the world. But actually, the fact is that we want to enjoy unlimitedly. Yeah? Isn't that a fact? Not just some lukewarm happiness. And that is the attraction in such verses. We want to actually experience love and affection, ultimately. Therefore, after years of actually trying to control our senses, we're still attracted to some of the love songs and the idea of love. Why? It's fine. It doesn't work. Because Srila Prabhupada said, if you try to become detached, you will go mad. I've got the reference somewhere. I don't have it with me. But I've got it. If you try to become detached, you will go mad. So on one hand, as human beings, all of us, we know we want to be happy. But because we're human beings, we can see some of the consequences. Just read the news, what happens with these loving relationships. Yes. What happens? It's so horrible that a man loves a woman so much that when she leaves him, he kills her. Hold on. Yeah. I loved you so much that if I can't be with you, I'll kill you. I mean, God, get real. It goes on. It is sad. But we want that love. Why? Because that is our real position. Therefore, we've almost got two choices, and neither are satisfactory. Either we become a diehard romantic. Yeah? We want that idea of romantic love. Yeah, we find that person, and on the other hand, we deny love. And we become hard-hearted. So one time of being soft-hearted, but then not very intelligent. And then the other side being hard-hearted. We have to somehow redeem our love and our affection. We cannot give that up. Uh-huh. And the question is, how do we do that? And really, there's a very nice verse in the Bhagavatam. I can't remember where it is now. But it goes like this. Every learned man knows that attachment to the material is the greatest cause of bondage and suffering. However, when such attachment is turned towards the devotees of the Lord. Mukta Dwaram Aparvritam. It opens up the doors of liberation. So this is important. We have to somehow or other develop that love. Therefore, such passages are very attractive, right? That happiness that comes from the loving relationship with Krishna. However, we shouldn't jump to that straight away. Like this devotee I saw in Birmingham, Dira. First, we have to become Dira. And I want to actually just read, because Srila Prabhupada gives some very interesting, extremely interesting definitions of Dira. Prabhupada, this simple thing they cannot understand. Therefore, it is mentioned here, Dhiras Tatra Namuyati. Dira means sober, cool-headed man. And just the opposite, Adira, means third-class, fourth-class man. Or rascals, Adira. Dira means sober, just like the exact translation is, you should all be ears now, all ears. The exact translation is gentleman. Of course, Srila Prabhupada says later on, gentleman doesn't mean just coat and hat. But still, Srila Prabhupada used this word very often. So in a sense, we should be very attracted to this idea of developing that loving relationship with Krishna. But in our stage, we really need to work on becoming Dira. The other important point is the change must be manifested in terms of one's real activities. So when we go out to chant Hare Krishna, I think there's some big kirtan today, that should be attractive, but behind that must be character. There must be some exemplary character. And Srila Prabhupada actually said this. So this, and this is a lecture in Tehran on the 13th of March, 75, on Srimad Bhagavatam 110, verses 3 to 4. So this is not a sentimental fanaticism, religious movement. This is a scientific movement for the good of the whole world. That we have to convince by our character, by our behavior, then people will accept it. So two things. We may be very attracted to that loving relationship, and we know that is the goal. But our stage, we should be also aware of our particular stage in devotional service and aspire to at least become Dira and to set an example that others will follow. Thank you. Hare Krishna. Questions?